Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Michael Leader.
I'm David Jenkins.
And I'm Lillian Crawford.
And today we'll be talking about James Gunn's Legion of Anti-Heroes Spectacular, The Suicide Squad, Edgar Wright's music documentary The Sparks Brothers, plus a short interview with the director himself, and in Film Club, the heavy metal documentary that out Spinal Tap's Spinal Tap, Anvil, The Story of Anvil. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Yes, welcome back, listeners, and welcome back, David. Always a pleasure to speak with you, and welcome, Lillian. You were last on the show at the tail end of last year, talking about Mank in our Mank special, but since we've relaunched, we'd love to take the opportunity to let our regular familiar contributors reintroduce themselves to the listeners. So, Lillian, who are you? What do you do? Where can we read your work?
So, I'm a freelance film and culture writer. I have written for BBC Culture, Sight and Sound, and Little White Lies quite often. I also run a blog and podcast called Listen to Lillian, all about British film history and hidden stories of queer and female filmmakers. So, that's what I do.
That's a great idea for a podcast. Where can we find it? Or should you just search for it wherever
It's on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and Google, the usual places.
Absolutely wonderful. So, unfortunately, we're not going to be talking about many of the stars of British film history on this show, because we're starting off with The Suicide Squad, this great, crazy, over-the-top comic book spectacular. That's coming up first. So let's do a little bit of synopsis. This comes straight from Warner Brothers. From writer-director James Gunn comes the superhero action-adventure The Suicide Squad, featuring a collection of the most degenerate delinquents in the DC lineup, including, this is a very long list, prepare yourselves, Bloodsport, Peacemaker, Captain Boomerang, Ratcatcher 2, Savant, King Shark, Blackguard, Javelin, and everyone's favourite anti-hero, Harley Quinn. So this is a sequel to David Ayer's Suicide Squad from a few years ago, commonly held up as one of the worst comic book movies to date. They've added a "the," they've changed the director, James Gunn, poached from Marvel for this film. Lillian, should we be excited? Should we bother with this one?
No, is the short answer, I would say. I would actually say that Ayer's Suicide Squad is possibly more coherent and enjoyable than this film. I don't know if that's because I saw Suicide Squad fairly recently, and I watched it on a DVD when I could turn the sound right down. This is a very loud and boisterous film, which I think the last superhero film I saw in a cinema might have been, DC film I saw in a cinema might have been Man of Steel. Which I left with my head absolutely spinning, and I vowed never to watch a DC film in a cinema again. Seeing it in the super screen at Cineworld Leicester Square was certainly reified that for me. It's just so loud. So if that's people's things and that's gonna get them back into a cinema, then great. But I did it took a while for my senses to sort of come back to me after seeing this film.
It certainly does seem quite colourful and self-consciously crazy and so on. But Lillian, where do you normally land with comic book movies? Are you generally a fan, or is it generally not your thing? Just so we can contextualise what you mean when you say this maybe isn't one for you.
Yeah, I love Marvel. I've liked the particularly sort of since phase three of the MCU, I've really enjoyed the more sort of playful and interesting films that they've been making. I particularly enjoyed Black Widow the other week. I've not so much the action scenes, that doesn't really do it for me. I like the scenes where people are sort of sitting around tables talking and acting. Logan's quite good for that. But yeah, in terms of DC, I liked Birds of Prey. That is a great film. I really enjoyed that. I think that the big difference between how Harley Quinn is portrayed in that film and the two Suicide Squad films is that she's just sort of allowed to be her own multi-dimensional character, whereas in this film and in Suicide Squad, she's very much there to be sort of ogled and fetishized. There's several sequences in this film where she is literally just sort of reduced to being a beautiful woman in a dress who sort of like is to be seen on the screen, and she's sort of fetishized in that way. There's definitely some like kinky stuff here that I would imagine is coming straight out of James Gunn's sort of fantasies. There's a scene where she breaks a man's neck with her thighs, and I just sort of rolled my eyes at that. I really didn't like this film.
Okay, so James Gunn, very much positioned as a titan of the comic book movie genre off the back of Guardians of the Galaxy 1 and 2, I should say Volume 1 and Volume 2 to be precise, coming off the back, you know, starting out in quite schlocky B-movies, now he's helming these multi-million dollar blockbuster projects. David, what did you make of The Suicide Squad? And do you see the hand of James Gunn in this?
Yeah, it's a very James Gunn film. I remember when I was very young, probably about 15, 16, seeing... I don't know if you remember, there was a TV channel called Bravo. And it was a bit like a kind of proto TCM, but then definitely in the evenings they would show quite sort of schlocky horror films. And I remember like my friend had cable. We didn't have cable, so we were at my friend's house, and we happened across a film called Tromeo and Juliet by the Troma Studios, which was actually written by James Gunn. And I do have very vivid memories of that film because it has lots of very obscene, lewd things happening in it. Like I remember I think Romeo has a giant sort of killer phallus in it or something like that, and it's got a very kind of James Gunn sort of humor vibe to it. And then he did this film called Super as well, which was a more kind of, it was his first kind of like almost sort of redux of the comic book movie when it was still kind of in its infancy, and it was a kind of low budget, violent, you know, quote unquote adult take on kind of comic book lore. And yeah, they obviously thought that he had that kind of sensibility and knowledge and for that world that would make him a good fit for taking on these kind of behemoth projects, like ensemble projects. And you know, whereas I think his Guardians of the Galaxy film definitely have a kind of, you know, toned down, tamped back James Gunn that is more of the sort of nostalgia and hitting that kind of PG-13 crowd with a few little yucks along the way. He's kind of, this is the sort of first occasion where he's been able to kind of go bring kind of full Tromeo and Juliet energy to a kind of studio project. And it is really, you know, it's almost kind of like the sort of splatter levels are like off the charts sometimes. I mean, it's all fairly kind of, it's all done in a very kind of comic hue. You know, it's lots of exploding heads and people being ripped apart, and you know, it's all done in a very kind of like playground style, and not it, the the kind of things that you would see in a in your usual kind of, you know, AA or what, you know, 18 rated computer game, you know. But yeah, I mean, I think the thing for me, the thing for me with this film is just, I just cannot get vibe with James Gunn's humor. I just found it like deathly unfunny, and he's got this kind of, you call it like psych humor, you know, where something sincere is happening, and then like your kind of 16-ton weight falls out of the sky and crushes someone randomly. It's very like Monty Python in that way. It's kind of like, let's cut through this kind of supposed moment of sincerity with like an exploded, you know, someone's head just explodes. Isn't that hilarious? And that just kind of happens over and over again in the film. If I was to sort of drag it back, I would say that I think that my memory of the first Suicide Squad is definitely not negative. It's definitely very negative. I think just because I found like the performances quite appealing, especially Idris Elba and the new, very 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 newcomer Daniela Melchior, and she's a real natural. She plays this character called Ratcatcher 2. And yeah, she sort of definitely brings a bit of kind of spark to an energy to the proceedings. But yeah, I just, it was one of those, I think if it had been like 90 minutes, it would have been fine, but it's 90 minutes. And then you've basically went at the point where you think you're at the end, there's a whole other film to come, and it's just tiring beyond words. I was really, it dragged like a mother.
Okay, well, let's put some scores on the Suicide Squad and we can move on to the next film. So, Lillian, I'll come to you first for this. This is In Anticipation, Enjoyment, and In Retrospect.
Yeah, I think my anticipation was definitely a one. As you said, Suicide Squad is a very bad film, would be a one-star film. James Gunn's humour does not appeal to me at all. He has a tendency to think something's much funnier than anyone else does, and then to really milk it. There's a gag in Guardians 2 about someone called Taserhead, and there's a very similar gag in this film, and it just keeps going, and no one is finding it funny. And then enjoyment, a one, and in retrospect, a one. I'm kind of tired of these films. They're not doing anything new or original that we haven't seen before. I hope people get bored of them and we can have more fun-loving Marvel films to enjoy.
David?
I'm probably going to go... for me, it wasn't a complete... I don't think it was a complete write-off. I think there was some sort of bit elements in there that were definitely salvageable. I mean, you know, it's probably twos across the board for me. Like, I mean, the fact that they've sort of remade this quite bad film so soon just in itself feels like a bizarre thing to do. So, I mean, it's barely like 5 years since the previous one, and it's such a kind of like, although it's a sequel in name only, really. It's you know, it's a reboot. It's a sort of super fast reboot where they've completely changed the tone. It's still very obnoxious though. So yeah, it's twos across the board. I'm not like, it's not, it wasn't like, for me, twos are worse than ones in a way. Because like twos are just like,
you're nothing. Shrugging.
Yeah, I'm shrugging. Sorry.
Although I must say, I think that must be a first for Truth and Movies. Maybe go back through the archive. I don't think we've had straight ones in a review before, at least on the podcast. I'm sure it's happened before in the magazine, David. But listeners, I know there are fans of James Gunn out there and of the Suicide Squad that's been getting, you know, people have been giving good reviews. If you do like the Suicide Squad or agree with Illy and David, let us know at the usual channels at Elderly Lives on Twitter or truthandmovies at tcolondon.com. Up next, we're going to be talking about the Sparks Brothers. But first, we had the rare and wonderful opportunity to speak with director Edgar Wright about making his first music documentary about the cult band Sparks, who'd been creating music for 5 decades, going through various phases of success, rise and fall, appealing to various different cult audiences. Of course, music has been very important to Edgar Wright throughout the years. Just watch one of his films and there's sure to be a great soundtrack and many musical moments in there. But this is his first documentary, and that's where I started with my first question. Edgar Wright, thank you so much for joining with me for Truth and Movies. So we're going to be talking Sparks today. So, but up until now, music has played such a role in your fictional filmmaking career, from the great soundtracks, the amazing musical sequences. I particularly loved the focus scene towards the end of Baby Driver. However, this is your first foray into music documentary, so I wondered, has the music documentary filmmaking ever been on your radar as something you'd wanted to do one day?
I don't know if I'd ever vocalized it out loud. I definitely love watching documentaries, and particularly music documentaries. And I'm kind of a sucker for a music documentary, whether I like the band or not. Sometimes the more interesting ones are about bands that you don't think you care for necessarily. But the way that this came about is that as a Sparks fan, I found myself saying aloud that somebody should do a documentary about them. And because I felt that they were the best and most influential band who did not have a documentary about them. And also I felt that even though they had a lot of fans and sort of pockets of fandom around the world, they're one of those bands that needed a bit of an overview, because even people who did know Sparks didn't necessarily know the whole story. And splitting time between London and Los Angeles, as I had been for the last 10 years, I was very aware that people had different images of who Sparks were, or their key album was a different album. And that was fascinating to me. So it would be wrong to say that all Sparks fans would go straight to Kimono My House, because that's not true. Like in the States, people say, oh, Angst in My Pants, you know, my favorite Sparks album. Well, that's the first Sparks album I ever had. So I was kind of curious about their story is such an interesting one, because it would be wrong to say that they've never had success, because obviously they have. But up until maybe like this century and the internet providing a bit of an equilibrium, they had had success in different territories at different times. And as such, their story was kind of more of a zigzag than like a straight kind of like arc going up, you know?
Absolutely. And that's actually, for me, that's the area of discovery for me, that whole 80s period where they had their K-rock phase, and you have your sort of Flea or Jason Schwartzman type guests who can speak to that. Because I go up to, yeah, the Marauder era is where I know them, and then there's a sort of blank until more recently when they start up again. So that was the real area of discovery for me. But I suppose in the process of putting this together, you have so many great sources of footage and insight. You have, of course, the stuff where you're shadowing them on tour. You have such great access to the brothers themselves, and then all these talking heads. So how did it start to take shape in your mind about the sort of documentary you wanted to do? Because there are almost as many ways of doing a music documentary as there are music documentaries.
Yeah, I think even in making it, there's some things that we did that like felt like, oh, this is good, but this is from a different kind of documentary. Like, strangely enough, there's some stuff that's going to be on the Blu-ray. There's quite a lot of extras and extra stuff, as you might imagine. And one of them is that we did a bit more on location stuff, getting Ron and Russell to revisit their old haunts. And it's really sweet. And there's some, and I put it all on the DVD but it sort of felt as you were doing that stuff as you were shooting it. And especially when you tried to edit it in, it felt like, oh, this feels like a separate arena of just this. Like, it doesn't feel like it fits into what's kind of happening. And I think what became to take shape very quickly is that they as talking heads and everybody else chiming in as an oral history was the way to tell the story. Because Ron and Russell are incredibly charming, smart, funny, self-deprecating, you know, very aware of themselves as interviewees, and that's kind of rare, where they're not afraid to laugh at themselves or even like smile at their misfortunes, which is different to kind of a lot of other artists who can't even sort of talk about the bad times necessarily. On the flip side, is like they're too modest to say the things about them that you need to bring in other people to say. And it's in a way that sort of is almost the reason to have the other talking heads, is to say the things that Ron and Russell themselves won't. And I guess I'm a sort of fan of, I like that oral history format in books. And I thought that there was a way of doing that in the documentary, because there are so many people to speak about Sparks over 50 years. I myself interviewed 80 people for the documentary, and I probably could have gone on if like we didn't have to stop at some point and make a movie, because I was quite happy to interview, you know, and there's a couple of people who didn't make it. Like one or two of whom I just put their interviews on the DVD, because I thought, well, you know, the engineer on Commando My House is like, he's got a good story to tell. Unfortunately, his 15 minutes couldn't make it into the movie, but it doesn't mean it's not usable. So I think that was the thing that was, and also I guess speaking to what you just said about the different periods, it's interesting that you mentioned that your knowledge goes up to 79 and then there's like a gap until 1994 when they came back. Now, what's amazing in that period is that Ron and Russell did not tour the UK between the years of 1975 and 1994. So there's like a 19-year gap in touring. The only thing they did at that was they appeared on TVAM and Wogan on like 1985 to promote Change, the single. But they were sort of absent, and they were in the States trying to crack the States. And like you said, it's like in the same way that you didn't know anything about the 80s period, some of the people that were all about the 80s period weren't aware of like the Island Records or Kimono My House, or hadn't seen them on Top of the Pops. So with that, so I was very aware that you could tell a story of a 50 year career with talking heads and basically keep kind of like gathering fans as they do. And that in itself was going to be hopefully increasingly impressive, because you get, you know, you're like an hour plus into the documentary, and then suddenly like here comes Jason Schwartzman to talk, or here comes Flea and Beck. Like, so I knew that would be quite powerful. And also, I guess the range of interviewees was an attempt to show their enormous footprint in culture. I knew as well, and this was part of my pitch to Ron and Russell, that to embalm them as a 70s band was absolutely not what they wanted. Sparks, I think, if you see them in any interview, one of the things that I think is like a really powerful thing about them is that they've always thought of themselves, and thereby other people do as well, because it's true, as a going concern. And that to me was the thing that was like, I guess like my fandom turned into full-on obsession in the last 20 years, because whenever I was like working, once I started making films, you know, and then I'd be, you know, in between films, I say, wow, like you get like a Mojo new music CD and go, wow, new Sparks. Or like sort of, wow, like Sparks are on Six Music. Oh, Sparks are on the A-list on Six Music. Sparks are on Jonathan Ross. Like, and it was this thing that they would, with new singles, which was like extraordinary. And I think in a way, because Sparks have had that career where they've always been beloved by some, but they've never reached the mainstream stratospheric success of Queen. But in a strange way, the music press and has given them a stay of execution. Like they've never like sort of fallen, they've never fallen foul of that tall poppy syndrome. Cause I think there's always like a bunch of music fans who are rooting for Sparks, because they're, if they are the perpetual underdog, that's not a bad place to be. Cause it's like, and I'm sure if you went back in time and said to Ron Russell, said, would you like to have like Queen's size success in the 70s? Or would you like to have what you have now? I would bet you they'd vote for the latter. Because what an amazing thing 50 years later that they've got two movies out in the same summer. And, you know, like, and countless artists saying like, naming them as a primary influence.
Absolutely. And you mentioned they have two films out this summer, with the Leos Carash film as well. And it really struck me. I hadn't, you know, it hadn't really occurred to me just how cine literate they were and how many potential film projects they'd had over their career. And I wondered, how much was that on your radar? Because it's a really fascinating thread you weave, of course, from the potential pun of the Sparks Brothers all the way through to mentioning, you know, in their lyrics, all the way to the Ingmar Bergman project, but then also the aborted film project throughout. Was that something that you were aware of as a fan?
I was aware of the Tim Burton project, but I wasn't aware of the full complexities of that. And then getting to know them and reading up, researching, I found out about the Jacques Tati project as well. So, but it's funny, the first time I ever met them for coffee in 2015, after a fateful direct message, like I discovered that Sparks were following me on Twitter. I felt like a dum-dum for not having followed them before. I didn't even, you kind of think that Sparks is too enigmatic to have a Twitter page. And then not only did they have one, but they were following me. So I immediately followed them back and messaged them and said, is this really the band? I'm such a huge fan. They said, yes, this is Russell. We're big fans of your movies. where are you based? Oh, I'm in Los Angeles. Oh, we live in Los Angeles. Oh, well, we should get coffee. Yeah, how about tomorrow? Literally all happened like that. It's crazy. And then, funny enough, at the first coffee that we had, Ron, and this was 2015, so this is 6 years ago, they mentioned that Leos Carax was interested in doing a film of this album, which they'd recorded but not released, that he'd heard the demo of this album for Annette, which they originally planned to record and tour like Tommy. You know, like a Who style concept album. And I, as a sort of Sparks fan, but also as a Leos Carax fan, I was like, oh my God, that sounds amazing. I hope that happens. And the irony is that when we started making the Sparks Brothers, right through, I basically shot nearly all of the Sparks Brothers before I started shooting Last Night in Soho. Mm. The two go hand in hand. I literally finished the first draft of Last Night in Soho, started shooting Sparks, and then through Sparks, kept doing drafts and pre-production, and then did a bit of filming of, and then filmed the Sparks Brothers right up until I had to start prepping Soho. And then during the shoot of Soho, we heard, hey, Annette's got the green light, because it hadn't necessarily been definitely happening. So I had said, as soon as I heard that, I said, we have to go to Brussels and shoot them on the set of Annette. Thank God. Thank you, Leos Carax, for giving us an ending to our B-plot in the movie. for selfish reasons, as well as being a film fan. And I can say that I've seen Annette, and it's amazing. I can't wait for people to see it. It's wild. It's just what you would hope a Leos Carax Sparks film would be like.
Absolutely.
I like the fact, though, is that the first like director that wants to make a film with Sparks is Jacques Tati. Mm. And then the one who actually makes the Sparks film is Leos Carax.
That's a century of French filmmaking there. It's taken that long for it to come around. I'd like to just ask about music documentaries. You said you do have quite a diet for them as a fan, as a film viewer. Did you have any in mind as this project was percolating, maybe about what you wanted to do or what to do differently? Because I do like that you have quite early on, you play with some of the tropes and cliches of rock journalism and rock documentaries about ripping up the rule book, pulling back a curtain, shining a light and all that. So do you have any films in mind when all of those things are coming together?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
I mean, I don't want to point the finger at any particular documentary because that would be like mean to do so. But I guess if I had a bugbear about music documentaries, is that, and this is not necessarily something that's a problem unless you happen to be new to the artist. So there are some documentaries, I've watched two that I could name recently, but I will not mention them by name, because I generally like them, but also I had prior knowledge of the artist. And I did think as I was watching it, I was thinking, if you didn't know their music, would this documentary let you in? And I feel like that's something that, like, sometimes there are like artists who are so big, like the Beatles or the Rolling Stones or Bob Dylan, where you could assume that people already know half the stories and then you can kind of get quite macro with it. You know, like the recent Scorsese Rolling Thunder Review documentary is a good case in point, is that you're probably not watching that documentary if you haven't already seen No Direction Home and Don't Look Back. Or like a lot of the Beatles documentaries, like Ron Howard can do a documentary just about the touring years because it's focusing on just one part of it, because there are like 10 other ones to watch as well in a whole TV series. But I felt with Sparks that like it would be, I had to make it as much of an introduction as it was a celebration, because you want people to fall in love with them and you want to, you know, kind of like, if you're not a fan at the start, you would love people to be a fan at the end. And I don't think you can really do that unless you let people in. And part of that was like spending a little longer with the music. It's probably the reason that it's slightly over 2 hours, is because I sort of wanted to make sure that you heard all the songs, that you didn't just kind of just like skip through them. And sometimes you would stop to hear a song for a bit, so everybody could, like you said, like a sort of compilation album is like, you get the measure of the band by hearing how they have developed and mutated over the years, and how 1971 Sparks is very different from 1981 Sparks and so on. And that wouldn't work if you were just kind of like rattling through it in a way that you could do with a Beatles documentary, saying, hey, we all know what Penny Lane is, so let's just move on, you know?
Yeah. If I could ask you about one last bit of the film, and it's a very small bit of the film. I'm a big Beatles fan, so of course the short animated interlude with John and Ringo, as voiced by Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, jumped out at me. It's a great anecdote in the first place about them seeing Sparks on telly, but please tell me about how that bit came together and getting Simon and Nick involved. Is it just that you need to have them in every one of your films as much as possible?
I mean, I just thought it was... well, number one is that Simon does a really good John Lennon impersonation. I don't know if you've ever seen the extra on Shaun of the Dead where Simon Pegg and Peter Serafinovich do one of the scenes as John Lennon and Paul McCartney.
I've not seen that. I'll go and dig it out.
Oh, I think it's called... what's it called? I should know this. It's not called The Man Who Would Be Shaun. That's another bit in that. Maybe it's just on the outtakes. It's Peter Serafinovich and Simon Pegg do an entire scene as John Lennon and Paul McCartney.
Wow.
So I knew that like sort of Simon could do a great John Lennon. And so I guess like some of the things that are in the movie where there's great stories but no archive, and because Sparks themselves have used animation and art in so much of their music videos and album covers, it was sort of a no-brainer. And in fact, Joseph Wallace, who did the amazing stop motion video for Edith Piaf, said it better than me from the Hippopotamus album. He was doing the stop motion stuff. We had a whole team of animators doing different things, like another guy called Greg McLeod, brilliant animator, did some of the other 2D animation. And Joseph Wallace and his team did a lot of the 3D animation. And then we had some other amazing artists doing like the manga stuff. So, but it was a great story, but it's like, why don't we animate John Lennon and Ringo Starr watching Top of the Pops? So Simon did the John Lennon bit, and I was going to ask Pete Serafinovich to do Ringo, because Pete Serafinovich can do amazing impressions of all the Beatles. But I think Pete was busy with something and I couldn't really pin him down. So then I thought, well, why don't I just ask Nick? And the funny thing is, Simon definitely watched the clip and has now seen the documentary. But Nick, to my knowledge, who I think was in the States shooting, had not I did not even watch the clip, but this is the funny thing with Nick Frost. So Nick Frost as Ringo Starr says only one word. He says, Hitler? Question mark. And so I called Nick and said, hey man, I really need you to do this voiceover for my Sparks documentary. It's just one word. You could do it on your iPhone. So then I got this message, a voice memo rather. And if you can imagine this, it's something that I should really release as an NFT or something like that. It's just Nick Frost in Los Angeles, not having watched anything, not really understanding why, but just recording on a voice memo as Ringo Starr. Hitler? 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 And it just like goes on for about 5 minutes. And I was thinking this, and I just said, this is your finest work.
Edgar Wright, thank you so much for your time. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much to Edgar Wright for joining us and geeking out about music and Sparks and music documentaries in general. So before we kick off the review, here's a quick précis, a quick synopsis of the film. How can one rock band be successful, underrated, hugely influential and criminally overlooked all at the same time? Edgar Wright makes his documentary debut with the Sparks Brothers, featuring commentary from celebrity fans such as Flea, Jane Wedlin, Beck, Jason Schwartzman, Neil Gaiman and more. The film goes on a musical odyssey through five weird and wonderful decades, celebrating the legacy of Sparks, your favourite band's favourite band. So David, that's quite a tall order. Your favourite band, introducing you to a band that have been working in many different genres over the years, five decades worth. Did you know much about Sparks beforehand? Did this film convince you that they were the great lost cult band of the last 50 years?
I think it certainly tries to. I mean, that's definitely its kind of mission statement is that, you know, Sparks are amazing. If you don't know about them, then you should. And if you do know about them, then you should know more. I'd like three or four of their albums, all from different decades, some of them sort of random charity shop pickups and a couple like they're kind of seminal sort of, I think one of their early albums, Kimono My House, which is an incredible album, which I very much liked. And I didn't know much about the people, about Ron and Russell Mayall. They're quite kind of enigmatic. I knew that, like, you know, Ron Mayall sat glowering at his keyboard and has a kind of toothbrush moustache that makes him look like Charlie Chaplin, Hitler, Delete is applicable. And they have a kind of almost cabaret sensibility to them. The film is kind of interesting in that, I mean, it's quite on the surface. It's a fairly straight music documentary. Very, you know, earnestly, unabashedly celebratory about them and their work. It's quite interesting in that it's sort of about artists who are very it's almost about that kind of like Sisyphean struggle of being an artist, where they kind of. They're sort of having these little successes and they're going back to zero, and they're having a little success and going back to zero, and it's like that they do have a kind, like that there is something quite interesting and almost a little bit tragic that comes through about their sort of like relentlessness to sort of proceed in this world that they've entered into. Even when the chips are very much stacked against them, I mean, like, you know, like one of the interesting things is they kind of, that they are very much kind of followers of fashion, sometimes anticipating fashion, but a lot of the time kind of they're like, you know, in the 80s they're pumping out new wave albums, in the 90s they're doing like kind of house albums, and you know, now they're doing this kind of sort of neoclassical thing that's quite unique. And, you know, early days they were kind of known as a glam rock band, so they're very like taking this core Spark sensibility of like literate, erudite lyrics and kind of Russell Mayall's quite kind of squeaky delivery and sort of flushing it through all these styles. And you kind of, and the fact that the film is so kind of relentlessly completist that, you know, it wants to give every little fragment of their career a shout out, you do really get a sense of that kind of arc of their career. So yeah, I mean, it's very enjoyable, I thought.
Yeah, I've gone sort of both ways in terms of the structure of this. It's chronological, it's mostly Talking Heads based. It really is, I liken it to the sort of greatest hits or best of you'd get in the 90s, a double disc where there are two tracks from every single album. It goes to like 40 tracks in the end, and it's, you know, when you're looking at that or maybe listening to it, it's quite a full meal. But then afterwards, what better way to really capture that, as you say, the dogged resilience of the band through boom and bust, to just keep going, try something different, try something new. And the thing that was the real revelation to me, so growing up watching Top of the Pops documentaries on BBC4, I've seen them performing This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us in the mid-70s many, many times, with many, many Talking Heads saying, gosh, what is this? Why is Hitler playing the keyboards? But knowing that they have a whole other career in the 80s where they almost abandoned the UK, where they were popular in the 70s, and then start courting a sort of West Coast, almost college radio, new wave type of audience. And so that's where the Jason Schwartzmans and Becks come into it. That's really eye-opening and fascinating. And then, as you say, David, a sort of comeback in the 90s and beyond, working with Franz Ferdinand in the 2000s. There's no better way to get that story across, I suppose. But Lillian, were you a Sparks fan? Did you know much about them? Did this sort of approach work for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I first heard about Sparks when Leos Carax was making Annette, and I told my dad that I was watching this documentary about Sparks, and he said, oh, they were that weird one from Top of the Pops. And I was like, yeah. That's basically what I learned from this. But I didn't actually realize that they'd done Seduction of Ingmar Bergman, which was something I'd listened to a few years ago, because that's just the idea of a sort of opera about film is very much what I love. And I saw Annette last week and I absolutely loved it. And I love that every song that they write feels so different, of a completely different style. It's very operatic in that they don't care if you can't hum along to it. It's music to service a narrative, which I find very compelling. And I think this film sort of captures that a bit. I mean, it's 140 minutes long, which is, you know, that's nearing Frederick Wiseman level length of documentary. it's quite a hefty film that really could probably have been done in 90 minutes if they'd had maybe a few less talking heads, because there's like 80 people being interviewed for this film, which is quite a staggering number. And quite a significant number of those probably don't need to be there. There's people like Jonathan Ross showing up to talk about them. And I just kept thinking, what was the reason for this interview? They're also shot in black and white for no reason, which is something I have a pet hate for. I think my favourite thing about this film is the animation, which is something that I haven't seen many people talk about in relation to this film. There's this really lovely sort of... A lot of documentaries try to restage things with actors, but this documentary does it through a really eclectic range of animation styles, from like paper cut to hand-drawn animation and claymation. And there's a fun cameo from Nick Frost and Simon Pegg as, I think it's as the Beatles, isn't it? It's like John Lennon and...
It's John Lennon and Ringo Starr.
Yeah, that's right. So I really enjoyed those aspects, and I really enjoyed... when they were looking at like the performance aspect of what they do, particularly when they were saying that they did a series of concerts of all of their albums back to back. I really enjoyed that element a lot more than just sort of a lot of men talking about how much they used to love Sparks.
Yes, I suppose that's really when you think about what would Edgar Wright do with a music documentary form, and that is, what does he do in his fiction films? He loves to be He loves to recommend, he loves to expose you to something that he's clearly very passionate about. And I definitely went away from Scott Pilgrim versus the World buying the soundtrack, and there are lots of deep cuts on there. I remember Spaced had an amazing soundtrack. Or he also loves collaborators. He has his returning friends, and this was probably the opportunity when you say, why is Jonathan Ross in there for a second, or Mark Gatiss in there for a second? I did have a bet with myself about which of the sort of early middle-aged or middle-aged British people will be wheeled out to say, I saw them on Top of the Pops, and it was Mark Gatiss. Sorry, spoilers, folks. But, so that they are probably the Edgar Wrightisms in here, the fact that you will have flashes of animation and great sort of stylistic flourishes whilst also telling this great, you know, two and a half hour long, as you say, Lillian, talking head documentary that tries to convince you this band is great. And it sounds like, and it sounds like they were, it was quite successful in that sense. But let's put some scores on this. David, what did you make of it?
Yeah, I'd probably give it, I thought it was like a, you know, a very enjoyable romp. I'd kind of, you know, I mean, it, I almost, like, going back to what Lillian says, I almost feel that, like, I agree with you about the talk, there being too many talking heads, and a lot, quite a few of them are not really adding to the, much to the conversation. But I feel that there's, like, there's even more stuff that you, like the fact that they were involved in all these film projects as well. I almost think you could make another film about all the film projects that they almost were involved with. Like massive anime projects, almost making a film with Jacques Tati. You know, it's that stuff I find is just fascinating. The fact that it was, it just kind of all came to nothing as well. I mean, it's just you know, the film doesn't sort of lean too hard on the sort of tragic element of their career, which is I guess in the spirit of their own music, I guess. So I'd probably give it fours across the board. Yeah, it was a romp, and I like Sparks. I like what they're about, and I'm glad that, you know, for me it's like a film that I think is doing a kind of public service in a way, and getting the good word out, so it gets extra marks for that.
Lillian, what are your scores?
Yeah, I did enjoy it, and I certainly, as David said, like the stuff about the project with Tati was particularly compelling, and I think it's great that they've been able to work with Leos Carax now, and that, you know, they've sort of put all of that energy that they've got in their music making into a big operatic film project, which I absolutely loved. I suppose this film does sort of build up to that in a way that does sort of feel like a prelude or almost a trailer for Annette. It does sort of end at the point where they're making that film. So I think I'd give it threes across the board for this one. It was just a bit too long. And there were too many aspects that I was just thinking, why is this here? But as David said, there's plenty to sort of enjoy, even if you don't really know who Sparks are or care about them.
Yeah, I think I'm more on David's side. I think it's as fours across the board. I love music documentaries, particularly this sort of music documentary. I'll watch any day of the week about a band who you've always heard of, but you know their catalogue is a bit too big to get your head around. And it is a bit of a public service, as you say, David. My maxim when it comes to music documentaries about bands is, or even biopics about bands, is could I just spend this time instead reading Wikipedia and listening to a couple of their albums, or reading allmusic.com and seeing what the big hitters are. And actually this really does give you that overview. I may not fully buy all of Edgar and his pals' reasonings about why every album is significant, but it at least now sort of know the sweep of this long career. And yeah, in retrospect, I've been listening to Sparks almost every day since watching this documentary, and particularly that new wave period in the early 80s. It's if you're fans of, you know, Devo or the Go-Go's, that those albums are great. I'd recommend checking those out.
My top cut is Number One in Heaven, their Giorgio Moroder synth album. That's amazing. That's my fave.
And I suppose the highest praise you can give a film like this is if it then makes you afterwards go and listen to the band and find something you not appreciated before. I definitely want to go and check out The Seduction of Ingmar Bergman. I remember that being on the radio, but didn't hear it at the time. But it sounds like I need to dedicate some time to that. But that's The Sparks Brothers. A bit more of a solid recommendation from us this week compared to The Suicide Squad, listeners. But if you do watch either of those films, let us know what you make of them. At the usual channels, at LWLies on Twitter, or truthandmovies at tcolondon.com via email. Up next, a quick film club off the back of our conversation with Edgar, where he mentioned one film that he would single out in the music documentary genre, Anvil, The Story of Anvil. A quick synopsis here. At age 14, Toronto school friends Steve Lipscudlow and Rob Reiner made a pact to rock together forever. Their band Anvil went on to become the demigods of Canadian metal, releasing one of the heaviest albums in metal history, 1982's Metal on Metal. The album influenced a musical generation, including Metallica, Slayer, and Anthrax, that went on to sell millions of records, but Anvil's career took a different path, straight to obscurity. And this documentary picks up on their story 26 years later, following a last-ditch quest for elusive fame and fortune. So, David, you talked about how the Sparks Brothers documentary shows the band just doggedly pursuing their musical craft over the years, whether they're in or out of vogue. This is a film about a band that very much went out of vogue and never really got back in, right?
Yeah, I could feel myself anticipating this actually when I was saying that. Those shots of at the beginning of the film of Lips working for a catering company with his like anvil beanie on and going through the menus. It's a strange film, actually. I haven't seen it since it came out in 2008, and I had a colleague who absolutely loved it, and it was his like film of the year, and I think that my memory of it is maybe like had leached onto his memory of it a bit, because I'd kind of thought of it very fondly, and actually seeing it again, I kind of thought I love the first half of the film, where it's kind of where you go on their tour, and it's more kind of it's got a kind of comic vibe to it, because it's all going wrong, and there's all these very he captures like on the director Sacha Gervais, he captures all these kind of little conversations and very very funny things that are happening on the tour, especially with the kind of the sort of tour manager who is kind of working pro bono for them just because she kind of loves what they do. And the second half of the film just gets, I've forgotten, but was reminded on this rewatch, it gets like quite maudlin, and it gets more tragic, and like there is like, you know, that there is this kind of dream of like him wanting to work with like the Lips wanting to reconnect with the producer who made Metal on Metal for this new album, their 13th album, and basically having to stump up like 13k to be able to do it. And you know, there is this kind of like, well, in reality this feels like a kind of full stop. I mean, there's like that, you know, you don't have recourse, like rational recourse to do it, and he ends up kind of taking the money off his sister and you're watching it and you think, wow, I can imagine this setup has probably happened like three or four times, and maybe a couple of times since. I think the irony of this in the same way as a Sparks doc, I think, is that after Anvil came out, they had this big, quite prolonged spurt of popularity. They suddenly got invited onto all these festivals, mm-hmm. and they'd become this kind of cult item that people, that, you know, this kind of underdog band that people loved. You do have this weird kind of function for the film where it's kind of, on one hand, it's making them not look very good and kind of like amateurish and sort of silly, and on the other it's kind of actually served quite a sly marketing purpose for them, and you kind of like, you're kind of left to sort of stand back and wonder, well, how how much did they know about that?
Well, Sasha Gervaisi was their roadie in the 80s, so had quite a close relationship with him, and I'm sure that was part of his plan was, you know, he loves the band, loves them, but also maybe bring them along on the screenings tour, get them to festivals, wheel them out in a similar way to how Rodriguez benefited from Searching for Sugar Man around a similar time. But Lillian, what did you make of Anvil?
Yeah, it's interesting, David, saying that this is a film of sort of two halves, because I knew very little about it. I'd sort of heard of it before watching it. And I did just find the first half very funny. And I kept wondering if this was... I didn't realise that this was actually a documentary. I thought it was like a mockumentary a la Spinal Tap. And I thought that the fact that the drummer's called Rob Reiner, I thought was absolutely hilarious. I thought that was an intentional gag. And then, yeah, it just sort of changes. It goes from being this sort of... We're sort of laughing almost with them on this mad tour that they're doing, to actually being quite a dark and depressing film, that these are men in their 50s who just feel like they've never really achieved what they wanted to achieve. I suppose it's sort of what Mia Hansen-Love was doing with Eden as a sort of fall and more fall without any rise in the music industry, and how that is just the story for most bands and groups, that because there are so many of them. And I think by the end of it I just found myself feeling really quite depressed. I'm glad they had some success at the end when they went to Japan. That was nice. And I'm glad that the film sort of served as a revival for them. I think that, you know, they'd really been through it and they probably deserved to see some of that success. But yeah, it was just this really strange experience of not quite knowing when I was laughing with and when I was supposed to be laughing at the latter makes me very uncomfortable. At least with Spinal Tap, you know that it's actors and you know you're allowed to laugh at them, but in this case it just felt a bit, I don't know, I just felt a bit uncomfortable at times.
That's interesting, because it is made from a position of great love and affection for the band, for their long-suffering, long-standing fans. It really strikes me, and we don't have much time here, so I have spoken about this film at length on the 90 Minutes or Less Film Fest podcast, if listeners want to hear what I make of this, because I think this is an absolute music documentary gem, particularly within films about metal, which is... You know, for every Metallica, and similarly to what you're saying about Eden, for every Daft Punk, there are going to be so many other musical artists out there who don't make it, don't go the distance, and have to then, do you give up on the dream, or do you take catering jobs in order to then play in your local bar for diminishing audiences and so on? But there's something about heavy metal where it's on stage, you're the rock god, and it projects this hyper, ultra cartoonish masculinity, or at least overcharged machismo, but then behind that, who are the people behind that? And we see that in this film, and it's such a fascinating flip side to something like Some Kind of Monster, which is Metallica's you know, we're a multi-platinum band and now we have to have therapy sort of film. Anvil is very different. There are some very key scenes between Lips and Rob where they have known each other for 40 years, they're friends to the end, but they just can't relate to one another. So there's something there about friendships and relationships, creative or otherwise. There's so much in this film. It's very interesting to hear about that film of two halves aspect, and maybe I need to go back and I've forgotten that part. But listeners, we'd love to know what you make of Anvil, the story of Anvil, as well as any of the other films we've talked about this week. Any other music documentaries you'd recommend, please send us in your tips. Maybe we'll cover them in a film club in a future episode. That's at LW Lies or Truth and Movies at tcolondon.com. Lillian, David, thank you so much for joining me this week. It's been a wild ride from Suicide Squad through Sparks to Anvil. It's been such a pleasure. Films next week, Zola, based on the Twitter thread, Stillwater, and Film Club is a Bette Davis classic, tying in with a re-release from the BFI, now Voyager. Listeners, please subscribe wherever you pod, and if your podcast player of choice lets you leave reviews, we'd love you if you left one for us. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.